So we're on now. And we were in the middle or at the beginning of talking about just the review that you wrote in 89. And again, I don't want to kind of cover it as we'll just rehash on tape what anybody can read. But I wanted to try to get more out if I can locate it. There it is. Some of the, you know, kind of maybe get into some of the ideas that are kind of the competing ideas almost that are expressed by these sort of different models. And you were kind of, you know, that's where we were in the, that's what you were in the middle of discussing, which mm-hmm. criticism of all these different models.
And yeah, well, I think the thrust of the review was really that work on simple chemical model systems didn't explain the results that we were getting with mutations, studying mutations of T4 lysozyme and certainly other proteins worked on by other people. The genesis of that really came from the idea that to write a worthwhile review, you have to have something to say. And there are a couple of reviews in the field that are like that, and they're, you know, what you would call the classic reviews in the field. And so certainly Kautzman's 59 review.
I think you cite them almost all, right?
Right. And
isn't there something by maybe Privlov? Is that the name?
Yeah.
A Russian?
Yep, absolutely.
One or two even, maybe two. But
yeah, and Nick Pace's review from 75 or around then. And I guess I looked at those papers and tried to figure out, you know, why is it that people still read them and how did they fit into what had happened before. And, you know, not that I could write a review that'll be cited in the same way, but the issue in general is what makes a good review. And there are a lot of reviews that are, you know, basically lists of papers that have been published on a topic, and those really aren't very useful because they don't have any sort of intellectual organization. And they're not really, often not very critical. And so that was also a challenge for me, is to write a review that actually was critical without actually being critical to the people that did all the work that I was, in a sense, discounting. So, you know, I had worked with a couple of people who had very different styles in terms of criticism. You know, Petsko is inflammatory and, you know, has a hair trigger about saying what he thinks about other people's work or
in print
being
as well
blunt.
As
yeah, yeah, well, yeah.
More so probably.
More so, yeah, than most people. Mm-hmm. And Matthews, on the other hand, is excuse me.
Yeah, sure. We're back on you were, right, you know,
yeah,
evaluating
so Matthews,
criticism.
Yeah, right. He's less critical, he's conciliatory in public, you know, he's generally encouraging, well-liked, by just about everybody in the field. And anyway, so I felt that there was some, you know, basically middle ground where where I could be critical without being insulting.
Mm-hmm. Well, in many cases, I thought also there was this sense that, yes, there was something to be gained almost from, I mean, like, you could totally discount Creighton's notion of cooperativity, or that's my opinion, is it, in the sense of it having any relation to reality, in other words, a map that you could do one-to-one. At the same time, the whole idea of discussing protein stability in the sort of non-mechanistic way you find to be helpful, at least as a even a sounding board sort of, if you know what I mean by that it's...
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question, but I would say, yeah, I took the parts of Creighton's ideas that seemed useful and then pointed out aspects of,
right,
of the
that,
work
that's
that just
okay.
didn't fit with the data, you know, that aren't accounted for
So that, again, maybe consistent. His view or his model, which is kind of a non-model or an amechanistic or unmechanistic model, you don't like or you don't find useful, but certainly some of the ideas behind wanting to construct something like that, mm-hmm. You found very helpful.
Yeah, and in fact, I think his ideas really form the intellectual basis of the review, and so that was the issue, really, how to present it, how to figure out what's really new, and his ideas are or were what's really new at the time, and people still don't generally accept them. They're hard to understand. They're hard to test experimentally, and yet they still account for, you know, the great majority of the data. Mm-hmm. So I think in considering the review, the process, first of all, was to figure out what to say, and then to figure out what topics to cover. And once I had a set of topics, it was actually pretty easy in the sense that I literally just got manila folders with the topic on it and went to the literature, mm-hmm. a lot of which I was already familiar with, and just took all the papers that I had and papers that I could find and put them in all these folders. And then I could break the thing down and deal with each of the topics, which are basically headings in the review, and I could just deal with them sort of one at a time. And, you know, I would say that Brian Matthews was very cordial about having me stay in the lab and work on this, and that, you know, literally I just come to the lab and mostly write all day.
You were still there, right? I mean, what can
I was still in Oregon.
You don't
yeah.
have to come into your own office. Or
well,
own
it was sort of one. It was sort of a funny thing. It was there was a game of chicken going on, which is with people at Utah.
Oh, okay.
Right, and the problem is, of course, you take a position somewhere, and to do any work, you need a lab. And so, the usual thing, and what happened in Utah, and what's happened here, is that the university agrees to renovate the lab, and so you come up with some plans, and you, you know, get some kind of preliminary schedule, and so then you make plans on when to move and when to get there. And of course, as soon as you get there, then your leverage goes down in terms of getting things done. And so basically the usual thing happened, which was the lab wasn't finished. And so basically to keep their feet to the fire, I just said,
you
well,
left again.
I'm not going to show up until...
Uh-huh. So you kind of came to see how things were.
I just visited, you know, back on the phone. Yeah, how's
right.
it going?
Oh, okay.
And it's not done. It's not done. Well, I don't see any point in coming. Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of knew you were going to have to do this because of other people's experience.
No,
or you just
no.
It was a whole evolutionary thing where you finally realized, God, this is how it goes.
There's no point in showing up if okay. I can't do any work there. So I stayed. Julie, who I was living with. Actually, I wasn't living with in Oregon, but my companion, as they say.
Yeah, my partner, my life partner.
Yes. Anyway, she had agreed to take a technical position in a lab in Utah, and in fact, she didn't have any excuse, so she left and moved to Salt Lake, and I was still in Eugene saying...
Because she had a job there, right?
Yeah, I mean, she had a job. She had to show up. Exactly. I had a job, but
oh, God.
I was like, you
not
know,
showing up.
Playing this game.
Oh.
And so apparently they were bets on whether I would really show up or not. There.
At Utah.
Yeah, exactly.
And they thought maybe you just were having change of heart?
Yeah, essentially.
Really? Because when it was clear, I mean, there was no, what do you call those things that... The bench, everybody calls it, but I mean, you know, like no desks or tables or chairs or computers in your lab and that sort of thing.
That's right. That's right. So it was fun. And in the event, the other funny part of it is that I had set up a cross-country ski trip to Yellowstone mm-hmm. with friends from Boulder. And it was set up for, I think, the second week of February, and I had expected to be in Utah in September. So I thought, well, gee, this is not going to be a problem. Well, I showed up a week before this trip, and then, of course, it was planned, and I decided what...
How long was the trip? Like 2 weeks?
So it was a week. You know,
oh, a week.
But I was there a week, and then I was gone.
You weren't skiing now.
Well, it wasn't a great way to make a first impression, I'll tell you.
But I mean, there was this issue of, you know, that... You know, I got the impression from, I guess it was that, you know, each institution that nominates a person for the Pew kind of has to, the head cheese, you know, kind of has to explain how the process works, and so a letter of theirs is included in the application. As a matter of fact, also from the chair of the department that you're, or of the division or whatever it is that you're in. So there's a, you know, there are two letters from people at Utah explaining why you're the nominee and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I got the impression from that they were kind of, again, there was a, you were part of, or you were the, kind of a situation, again, of beefing up a department, of building something solid I guess, in structural bio, or, you know, just in the whole biomedical research thing, so that there must have been some sort of sense on your part, too, about, I mean, that they must have talked to you about this, you know. We are doing this, we're planning on
absolutely, that. Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's in fact...
And since we're on it, we can get back to the review. I mean, we don't have to cover it right here, but since we are on the issue, we might as well kind of...
Well, I mean, the review, you can read the review.
Oh, well, I've still got a few questions about it, but we can go on with it.
There's nothing in the review.
Well, there's all sorts of things in the review. But I guess maybe from a different kind of... I'm thinking about it as... all right, I want to ask my questions about the review. We'll get back to
sure.
Utah. I think there... And I can't remember if I talked to you about this on tape, or I talked to Hillary Nelson, or I've just been talking to myself in my sleep about it. So,
yeah.
If you recall that we spent 20 minutes on this already, shut me up. You can do my job for a second, and I'll try to pretend that I understand protein stability, and I'll do your job. I get the sense that a lot of emphasis has been put on the highly conserved, you know, 25 base pair, you know, sequence of whatever, where the protein folds, that, you know, and this is what's important, and we have, you know, this is what we have to figure out, this is what we need models of, and you call it the floppy part. All this other stuff, you could mutate the heck out of it, and it'll still come out, you know, it'll still look like this protein, it'll still fold and unfold pretty much, sometimes even more, it's more stable, right? Which is another question I have later. Why isn't there why does the possibility of the fact that the floppy stuff, and in its floppiness, not just from a kind of theoretical view of, oh, a natural selection demands diversity and flexibility, why can't that be seen as having a fundamental role in the folding and unfolding process? Because, of course, it's, you know, it's this huge kind of barrier area or border area between, let's say, areas that are going to be more rigid and more stable. In other words, is there another way to turn this around, or, you know, turn the question upside down?
Well, I think the attitude comes directly out of the experiments, and that is that the regions that are floppy tolerate changes. They can be replaced at will in general and still get function. Tony Poteet has done an unbelievably tedious but interesting experiment with T4 lysozyme where he set up a system where he could mutate every position one at a time and put in one of 13 different amino acids.
At each position?
At each position. And check for function.
On the outside or on the floppy areas around them?
The whole thing. Starting
at...
Yeah, it's actually starting at residue 2 and going to 164.
And you're working on the short one.
So... Right, so he did all this work to make these mutations called AMBER mutations that normally stop the protein. But in certain strains of bacteria, the AMBER codon or the AMBER, the stop signal is read as an amino acid. Mm-hmm. So that amino acid gets inserted at some frequency. Okay?
Right, yeah.
So then you produce the protein that has that amino acid where it used to have the stop codon. And then to make another mutant, you just take the same DNA and put it into a bacterial strain that puts in a different amino acid instead of stopping. Okay. So it's a quick way, I mean, relatively quick way to make many mutations at every site in the protein. And all you have to do is engineer one mutation at each site, and that's stop.
Got it. And then you can just run it kind of as one long experiment.
Right.
Right. Okay.
You get this huge table, right?
It's tedious, but...
Right. Horrible. I wouldn't want to have done that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The
result is, right, that there's only one position in T4 lysozyme that has to be what it is.
To get the protein to fold and
to get it
unfold.
To work.
Okay.
No, to get it to work, not to get it to fold.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So and just to make sure that I understand what difference we're talking about then between it working and folding for it to...
Enzymatic activity.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So if it has to fold to function.
Got it.
And that's not to say that every substitution at every position works, but there's only one position that can only be one amino acid, the one that's found in the normal protein. And that is an amino acid that is the heart of the catalytic mechanism of the reaction.
And to you, that's further indication that really this floppy stuff is just floppy stuff. I mean, it has its function and its purpose, but it's really of very little interest in solving this rather difficult question about protein stability.
No, I wouldn't actually go that far. Well, in terms of protein stability, yeah, I mean, the floppy stuff is the floppy stuff, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's one sort of caveat that actually the person that has done the best work in this is Bob Sauer at MIT, where it comes from the notion that the stabilizing contribution comes because an amino acid changes its environment in the folded structure relative to the unfolded structure. Mm-hmm. And the unfolded structure is, by all measures, very floppy, very...
the whole thing becomes floppy.
Yeah,
in a sense,
yeah,
right?
Like boiling spaghetti or something, yeah. And even so, on average, each amino acid might find itself inside of this ball of spaghetti some fraction of the time. And so that sort of led to the idea, well, are there amino acids in proteins that are outside? In fact, they're so far stuck out there on the outside that they're exposed to solvent more when the protein's folded than when it's completely unfolded, even though in the unfolded chain, residues are highly exposed to solvent.
All of them are.
It might be covered up more when the thing is unfolded.
Okay.
And so that's an example of something that's outside that may be important. And even if it's outside, it still might have a role. Things that are floppy and outside would tend to get covered up occasionally and so couldn't serve this other type of role. Floppiness, it's important in the sense that the chain has to lose it to fold. Okay, and so it's a critical determinant of stability. Its major role is in the unfolded chain. How floppy is the unfolded chain? And in fact, that's sort of one of the major questions that we're asking in the lab right now, is how much floppiness is lost when a chain folds, and how much energy does that take? So I don't think of floppiness as unimportant, but basically what we showed was that interactions in floppy areas apparently don't count. They apparently don't contribute as much to the to the structure.
That's what I mean, this yeah. His name was Tony what? I mean, the person.
Poteet.
Okay.
At UMass Amherst.
Okay. So he's not of the Matthews clan or...
He actually, after he got halfway through this experiment, he went to Oregon and did a sabbatical.
Okay, so he's a convert or a supplicant or whatever the religious image of the person who makes the pilgrimage to at least... and I guess I didn't want to kind of say, oh, you should be looking at the floppy stuff and kind of put the other stuff in the background. I was just curious, is it maybe more frightening to think of the floppy stuff as needing to be investigated with the same sort of rigor because it's going to be even less willing to be subjected to mathematical rules or to a kind of regular or a model. If it's if your description of it is spaghetti, right, in boiling water, you've got a real mess on your hands. And
no, in fact, our work now on the floppiness of the unfolded chain, it's actually more mathematical than any of the work.
Kind of thing, right? You just kind of forget it's spaghetti and boiling water, but you just kind of look for point. I mean, you don't even have to kind of think of it almost as stuff in stuff and distinguishable, right? But just as kind of a grid or a, well, I think of my very simple understanding of Fourier fields or whatever they're called and that sort of thing is, yeah, being much more easily mathematized. But then again, as you point out here in this art, I think in the review, there's a lot lost. I mean, what a biologist wants is not nice, elegant mathematics, perhaps, but...
Well, one of the people who's done the most careful work lately on sort of mathematical models and of the unfolded chain and the implications of those models is Ken Dill, who was a Pew scholar, so you might have interviewed him as well.
I think was interviewed by the Beckman. I think I actually only briefly looked at his...
His work interview. Actually extends predictions that go back to the 40s about the randomness of the unfolded chain. And we've actually, done measurements for the first time to test those mathematical models.
And are they kind of close? I mean, do you think the testing will correct it or in a worthwhile way, or think it'll... Maybe it's too early to tell?
Well, I would say it's not too early to tell. The bottom line in terms of the results so far is very exciting, that the models are basically correct, that there is a significant energy contribution to lose randomness. But the results also show what might be called second-order effects, and I sort of scoffed at second-order effects on the last tape, but... The results show that different parts of a polypeptide chain, or seem to indicate that different parts of a polypeptide chain have different degrees of randomness. And so, one of the simplest predictions of the mathematical theory is that the amount of randomness that's lost is a function of the length of the chain, and that's it.
Huh.
And what we've shown is that in general that's true, but in detail there are deviations. So it's not a simple linear relationship. And we don't really know yet whether that has to do with differences in the compositions of the chains that we examined in the experiment, or whether there's actually structure in the unfolded chain or the unfolded state that makes certain collisions more or less probable than random. And so that's, in essence, where our next experiments in that system are going, is to rule out these models for where the prediction of this chain theory or polymer theory is breaking down. That's been a really fun set of experiments. That, in fact, is what we did with the Pew money in instead of doing the cavity work that I originally proposed.
And so you didn't, you know, that's, and we'll just get in the plug for the pew, right? I mean, in a sense, that was perhaps a boon, because you didn't have to, like, resubmit, you know, call up the pew and say, oh, what I originally proposed didn't work, now, you know, will you prove this? Mm-hmm. I mean, you just mm-hmm. kind of...
Oh, yeah.
The money was there to be used, and you needed to change direction.
Well, also just to be used for something creative.
Right, and that's...
Right.
That's certainly creative. I guess one reason I'm kind of pushing or really kind of asking a lot of questions around this area about models and mathematical or the application or use of mathematics in your work, and it's not only because it's, I think, something you're always looking for and pushing yourself, it's also because of all the different areas of biology. It seems that, you know, the structure function look at proteins is one of the few areas where that's a serious endeavor, you know, where like polymer chemistry and the kind of other disciplines. I mean, Ken Dill is I believe, has his PhD in physics, right, mm-hmm. from UCSD, or a joint degree in physics and mm-hmm. chemistry and not in biology, you know. I forget where he is now, but I mean...
UCSF.
Okay. In a typical biological...
Pharmaceutical situation. Chemistry. Yeah.
And perhaps protein design, I suppose, or... No? Okay. Well, then I'll...
They don't do experiments.
They think?
Computer models.
All computer models, yeah. Okay. And don't get me wrong, I understand that a lot of the materials and whatnot, and computers are used in a lot of other areas of biology, but people who do protein transport are not looking to mathematize the mm-hmm. secretory pathway. They're looking to, create it in vitro and reconstitute it and then stick it back in vivo and get this, you know, and they're still doing very much the... what I guess I would call, you know, experimentalist approach and the just simple gathering of facts.
Yeah, I mean, but that's a much more complicated system, and so the idea is that can proteins be simplified enough so that they can be described in terms of mathematical rules or algorithms, and whether those algorithms have anything to do with the physical world or not. I mean, that's sort of the standard approach, is to say, let's write an algorithm that recapitulates the physical world, but it may end up being that proteins are too complicated for that, and we'll end up writing an algorithm that just predicts how the physical world is going to behave.
Okay. Which is, in a sense, maybe what a lot of physics has finally kind of decided it needs to do, right? I mean, I think that a lot of the perspective of quantum, you know, the quantum representations of the world are guesses at possible outcomes of the behavior of the physical world, not a mm-hmm. picture mm-hmm. of any part of the physical world. It's an averaging over, you know, trying to account for all the different events or effects on a particular event that can happen.
Yeah. Well, I would say, you know, to get back to your question about flappiness and the emphasis of that in the review, flappiness... You know, it's something that Greg Petzko works on. It's a recurring theme in his career. It was certainly the floppiness in transphosphate isomerase that got me interested in folding at all, or to the point where I think I wanted to work on that as a problem. Folding is a problem, and folding is certainly a process where the chain loses floppiness. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not that I was. I didn't really intend to discount it in the review.
Oh, and I guess
in that sense, as saying, you know, it's not important. But I think what I was saying is that if it's left in the folded structure, then it didn't really change very much mm-hmm. when the protein folded.
No, I guess I was suggesting or asking, you know, not even having my own opinion really, or my own thoughts on the subject that, oh, you're missing, you know, aren't you missing the real treasure trove to be found? It's all in the floppiness, not in the...
Well, a lot of the function is in the floppiness, and that's
it's a critical
a matter of what faith, or there are parts of that statement that are completely obvious. I mean, it's trivial to say function requires floppiness, and evolution requires floppiness, and blah, blah, blah. But to actually do an experiment to show how a change in floppiness or flexibility alters the function, that's very hard.
And isn't that the same sort of kind of situation you ran into with this unpublished paper that actually, you know, kind of helped maybe you and Peter Kim kind of become friends as well as intellectual soulmates or whatever, and that this other professor that you showed it to said, well, yeah, that's, or that a reviewer said, well, yeah, it's obvious. And kind of like, okay, so it's so trivial as to be obvious, and yet you said, this is with a, mm-hmm. you know, that yeah. you said, but no, it's really hard. It's so obvious, yeah, but how can we, you know, recapitulate it or reconstruct, make it happen in an experiment or even just demonstrate that indeed what we think of, what we hold as dogma is so obvious and there can be kind of shown in a step-by-step way to be indeed what
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to have an idea about yeah. that aspect of protein molecules or DNA molecules, but it's hard to to test those ideas.
Mm-hmm. I guess another reason that the area of floppiness kind of struck me or held my curiosity was the mention in the review that still it's there, this floppiness is not some sort of ideal random situation, and indeed there, you know, the floppiness has probably, you know, a way of being, if you will, that falls within certain parameters. Mm-hmm. It was obviously something that had handles which one could start doing this kind of work on. In other words, it wasn't some sort of...
That's a active area in the field now,
yeah.
defining what structure is there in the unfolded chain.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like really hard. really hard.
Yeah, it's hard. It's also what anti-dogmatic in the sense that, you know, until the 80s, really people considered the unfolded chain to be random, and there are lots of experiments that support that view that it's the proteins become random when they unfold.
You cite some work at least, or maybe it's theoretical work, but I thought it was experimental that. Indeed, it wasn't completely right.
But that's so. Quite recent.
Okay, and that's, and who, you know, I can't remember, who was that? And I know you're working on it now, too, so was it your own work, you know?
No, some of the first work was from Buzz Baldwin's lab, although it wasn't interpreted that way, and then someone who's, you know, sort of made a crusade or a career out of this is David Shortle, to look for non-randomness.
Okay. And, so this is really, as you said, this is a whole kind of, these kinds of questions that I'm kind of thinking, well, gee, why aren't we, it's really, I mean, since 89, let's say, since the review, that's really become an area that's received more attention, or that was at the time of the review starting to become a...
Well, I think intellectually, I mean, from a historical point of view, mm-hmm. it was an important question that had to do with a question of where is the information for the fold.
Okay.
And the idea is that people could purify proteins from living cells and denature them.
And then renature them.
And get activity back. But the criticism of that work was a proposal or a contention that, well, maybe there was something, some kernel of the structure that didn't get destroyed when the protein was unfolded. And that kernel was sort of established biologically. It was established during the process of synthesis or during the lifetime of the protein in the cell. You know, there's some cellular factor or function that imparted this kernel of structure that was needed for the thing to fold, and it just wasn't destroyed in the unfolding steps. And so it wasn't really until ribonuclease was synthesized chemically mm-hmm. with no cellular participation, and then where the chemically synthesized material was refolded and reconstituted, that was really the nail in the coffin of the question: is there some kind of biologically required step for folding?
Is that still, I guess, and it's something that I'm really fascinated by. Is there still some sense or kind of a, if you will, the biology police of a notion that that there is something about organic systems that is undefinable or not reducible to mechanical kind of analysis and description. It's almost like the cooperativity of Creighton is kind of, at least it's a holistic kind of attempt or an attempt to challenge the hopes, if you will, and the dreams of those who would like to be able to reduce this all. And we use the word reduce in the notion of reductionism as not a pejorative, unless you're a holist, of course, notion, but as something that science in Western culture has certainly been working at for a couple of centuries at least.
I don't think there is anything that molecular biology as a mainstream, as a social activity, cultural activity, I don't think there's anything that molecular biology would say is not reducible. That's a different thing from saying, is there anything about living things that's historical? And so you can see that in sort of maternal effect mutations.
Lots of
different organisms, right? That there's something that's imparted from in the egg.
Right.
And, it requires a history for the organism to grow. And so probably at this point there's a lot of... You would find a lot of skepticism about the sort of growth of dinosaurs, for example, that you saw in Jurassic Park.
But
if you had the DNA, you could make an organism.
Right. You'd probably need a little bit more than...
Right. That there's something... You'd need the egg.
At least, right?
Right.
If not the egg and the... And the sperm as well, I guess in certain situations.
You don't need sperm, my God.
Poor Aristotle, all those homonunculi theorists, right, out the window.
No, I mean, it's not, I think everything is reducible, but that doesn't necessarily mean you can put Humpty Dumpty back together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess I wasn't even so much as getting it from that view of, I think maybe this talk that Sidney Brenner gave at the Pew meeting in March in Hawaii is, got some, he's doing it for shock value, but he's also got a point, molecular biology, and then biology, since we cracked the genetic code, isn't anything more than about being Frankenstein, and anybody who tells you differently, we're out there to stop disease and blah, 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 says, it's baloney, we're here to be able to reconstruct life in a laboratory situation, and that's what we're going for. And again, he was trying to wake up a very, very tired audience who spent the whole day listening to papers, and it was now like after dinner and they were really tired and jet lagged. But I think he's also making an important point. But I was getting at this approach or getting at the suggestion that is somebody like Creighton maybe kind of saying, let's drop the mechanistic and the reductionistic approach for a while because maybe we're missing something. That we've got all these trees we want to put together, and that we may be missing what the forest really looks like, or something like that. And whether that was an issue you dealt with, or it's something you just think is
well, I don't think of his work that way at all.
And I was just taking.
He's proposing a mechanism for cooperativity. It's not that he's not being mechanistic.
Right, okay.
He's talking about how interactions might change each other mm-hmm. if they occurred together. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's really a mechanistic idea. It's hard to test, but you know, nonetheless, it's there is some mm-hmm. experimental support for it.
I guess one last thing, and I won't go into a, you know, through a whole lot of it, but one thing that's occurred to me is, let's take our ideal biochemist, okay? This biochemist thinks that a biochemical approach, or chemical, right, of put this in and see what comes out at the end, approach is a better than a structural, functional, or a structural approach, and that's perhaps why they're doing it. that's the way approach they like. And they are much less worried about rules and models and generalities. They're looking at their stuff that they've got as a chemical, right, or as a compound of chemicals, and they want to see what happens to it, and they run mm-hmm. it through their mm-hmm. in vitro system, or they reconstruct it, or they do it in vivo again, finally, and label it and check it out. And they, the ideal biochemist, who, let's say, is a little over-secure or a little whatever in her or his field, would say, ah, the structural function stuff. They're just getting into asking questions that, you know, are going to take, they'll never answer them, and mm-hmm. That sort of thing. And what they want to do in biology and to biological systems is just too far off in the future or not important about, you know, curing disease or delivery of drugs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And how would you, I mean, you obviously would probably have a different opinion with them because you're doing structural, you know, functional studies. And I guess I kind of, you know, do you see the payoff coming in this series, like in your lifetime? or is this, you're just doing one little bit of work along the way of a whole, you know, series of work that maybe begins back with certain chemists, like, what's his name?
Him.
Is it Hook?
What's his name?
Stop. No. Come on, who is it? What's his name? Hook, right? Priestley.
I don't even need to, you know, get into this debate with your ideal biochemist.
Okay.
I mean, it's silly. I mean, the payoff is already happening, as you say, the social payoff. I think that's what you mean by the payoff. The payoff is happening, you know, to produce products, and
good
people
model.
Are being paid off in terms of getting rich. And, it's a difficult problem. You know, I mean, protein stability is a difficult problem.
But it's
that's
solved.
Sort of what you're saying.
Well,
and I guess when I went to Oregon and started applying, you know, this new combination of approaches that other people had, you know, worked out all the individual methods, I thought, hey, we're going to solve this problem. And of course, now I'm much more pessimistic about it in terms of. How solvable is this problem? Is there going to be a theory that, you know, will explain the stability of proteins, a mathematical theory? I'm very pessimistic about that. But
you mean while you're still around doing it and working on it, or, you know, like 2 centuries from now, or are you not even?
Well, yeah, certainly in my lifetime. But I mean, I could. I think of, you know, the finding that the thermodynamics of protein denaturation is really complicated. That is a basic advance that happened, say, starting in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a big concept, and the notion of sequence homologies implying structural homologies. You know, that's a big idea in structural biology, and you know, that's something that's developed despite our inadequacies.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that proteins tolerate mutations, and that what's important is inside. You know, and that the volume of a cavity that you leave after you've made a mutation affects the mm-hmm. outcome of the mutation. You know, these are ideas that can apply to any protein, any mutation, to any structure, really, that anybody determines about
okay.
in any biological process. And so I would say, you know, we are getting much more sophisticated about looking at structures and seeing what's important, what can we do. In terms of practical applications, people are getting much bolder about modifying proteins to change their intrinsic activities to be useful in the sense of what saleable.
Mm-hmm.
And
I can see protein engineering as a sub, as a discipline within an engineering department, like in the next, what, 10 years or something almost.
Yeah, I mean making proteins more stable for industrial catalysts or changing their specificity so you get start with different starting products or you end up with different final products. And these are really active areas that people are doing, and you could say, well, you know, it's monkeys typing on typewriters and you may get Shakespeare, but yeah, you may get Shakespeare. And what's happened in the last decade is that there are a lot more people typing because people have realized that proteins can be manipulated.
Mm-hmm. And when you mean monkeys, you mean just any old dodo head is doing this kind of work now?
Well,
or?
Sometimes, yeah.
Okay,
but
okay.
It's certainly not anybody with a coherent theory of what's going
to
happen.
They're just really, well, and you know, engineers aren't necessarily supposed to, right? They kind of,
yeah.
It's the old notion that they built these medieval cathedrals without any even clue as to what was
yeah.
the theory behind why they stayed up, and sometimes they didn't. They
right.
fell down,
right?
Right? And they had little manuals on how to build a cathedral. Well,
maybe that's a really good analogy.
No explanation
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
They couldn't tell the person who was building it, this is why it's standing. Especially, of course,
yeah.
The dome structures that they were making in such huge, you know, with almost no support. Sort of, yeah.
But, you know,
that's actually
there are huge corporations now designing, modifying,
mm-hmm.
getting out new proteins, formulating proteins as
drugs.
So much
for intelligent drug design as opposed to hit-or-miss drug design?
Well, no. I mean, what people call intelligent drug design is, you know, not completely successful right now. But that's what people are working on.
Yeah.
And even the sort of most staid, most conservative corporations are designing drugs rationally rather than just screening libraries of compounds now. People want to know what is the target, what is its structure, how might a potential drug fit into that structure. And so the whole, you know, culture of how you make a drug is changing.